This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Mention among publications, numerous publications, I think she's written more art criticism than anyone else. Counting something like 200 pieces somehow. She has a wonderful novel, Oriental Girls Desire Romance, which I recommend, a first book, Copying Machines, a discussion of French literature and theory focusing on the 18th century. What she's going to present today is from the following book that has to do with paranoia and stars and conspiracy theory. With this, I please welcome Catherine Yu.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean-Michel. This is a real work in progress, so as I go along, I'm going to talk extemporaneously about things that I've sort of been working on, especially since I discovered much more about astrology recently. So I haven't had the time to fully metabolize it in the form of this paper. I'm going to start, and then Jean-Michel is at the end will respond, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. In undertaking a genealogy of contemporary forms of irrationality and superstition, I have been struck by the failures of critical thinking to account for this aspect of our modernity that lies at the conjunction of religious experience, technology, and new forms of mediation. The generalization of alternative forms of spirituality, explicitly or implicitly identified as New Age, has presented itself as a therapeutic alternative to monotheism, and its optimism regarding the possibilities of a realization of spiritual experience in relationship to technology has underwritten a mystical eclecticism that has had profound influence on the practices of everyday life in the industrialized world. In Sleeping with Extraterrestrials, The Rise of Irrationalism and the Perils of Piety, Wendy Kaminer has written a compelling critique of the therapeutic culture of the 90s in relationship to the decline of secular values in the political sphere. She rightfully points out that a generalized tolerance of religiosity and superstition in popular media and political discourse has actually suffocated a debate about secular culture, whose terms were much more honestly put forth by the uncompromisingly skeptical H.L. Mencken half a century ago. Today, those who address religion and religious beliefs are more likely to bend over backwards in protestations of tolerance. For Kaminer, the return of religion has been nothing but detrimental to the climate of political debate in the United States. What Kaminer focuses on are the most extreme forms of recovered memory culture, UFO abductions, satanic cults, and she really isolates their immunity to argument, to reason, to discussion, and their abdication of all political and personal responsibility in the name of therapy. But what such hyper-rationalist critiques of contemporary forms of irrationality fail to account for are the psychological attractions of irrationality, as well as the sedimentation of spiritual eclecticism that it represents, especially as a symptom of modernity that can be understood historically in relationship to 19th century's obsessions with occultism. On the other hand, we have a philosophical re-engagement with religion's return that is far less critical than Kaminer's. In La Trace de la Trace, Gianni Vattimo suggests that the return of religious experience cannot be fully translated into a language for argumentative rationality. This is extremely worrisome for liberal democracy, which depends upon the effectiveness of reason in the public sphere. To imply that a remainder of religious experience, which Vattimo describes as being based upon a feeling of sin and the need for redemption and forgiveness, cannot be overcome in the sphere of reason forces us to confront the impossibility of securing a sphere of secular and rational political discourse. With the return of religious experience as a positive and positivist phenomenon, the field of anthropology has embraced the renunciation of a modernist and therefore enlightenment narrative, which has led in that field to the privileging of anecdote over theory. interpretive processes are emphasized over both theory and empiricism. These anthropological strategies of dealing with objects of study, such as religious experience, have had a profound effect upon the critical practices of theory in both cultural studies and literary studies. And I want to point out that in an essay in Lacan in America, Joan Kopczak actually identifies 19th century positivism with occultism, which I think is interesting. But on another level, the anthropology departments in the United States are very interested in religion and media as two things to think through. But I think from a very different, the entire methodology that they're approaching the subject with is very different from what I'm going to outline today. In response to Vattimo's invitation to think about the return of religion, Jacques Derrida takes on the question in relationship to mediatization, virtuality, and the tele-technologization of the spiritual message. His critique of ecumenical Christianity and its global broadcasts at attempts at reconciliation with all the monotheism points to its will to power over all the airwaves. I am not going to do justice to Derrida's arguments in Foi et Savoir, but I want to point to its role in allowing for a theorization of virtuality, technology, and spirituality. For Derrida, as for Samuel Weber, the very category of the religious cannot be thought through without an account of its mediatization, that is, its televisualization and cyberspatialization. I hope eventually to add a historical dimension to this theorization, and I hope to convince you that in order to deal adequately with the return of religious experience, we must confront the popular and populist millenarianism and eclectic spirituality of the New Age. Vattimo and Derrida do not provide an account of this particular form of religious returning, but they provide a framework for our thinking through of its most important features and its origins in the European 19th century technopolitics of occultism, colonialism, and the reception of Eastern religion and the translation of major texts like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which took place at the end of the 19th century. I would like to propose that the virtuality of spiritual life must be considered in relationship to the psychology of long distances, put forth by Theodore Adorno in his book on the astrological columns of the Los Angeles Times. This book is called From the Stars Down to Earth. For Adorno, astrology demands a form of pseudo-belief that allows us to have a relationship of pleasurable submission to distant and all-powerful forces. He describes this popular relationship to the stars as one that is derived from a fantasy of sex without consequences. Now, when we hear about the idea of sex without consequences, we usually think of some kind of libertine or transgressive set of behaviors. But for Adorno, nothing as liberating as libertinage results from this fantasy. Sex without consequences forms the basis of the superstitious and the authoritarian personality, both of which want to enjoy a privileged relationship with an all-powerful and distant paternal figure. Adorno demonstrates in The Stars Down to Earth that the reader of the Los Angeles Times astrology column is psychologically disposed to passive acceptance of the power of distant authorities and, as a result, to anti-intellectualism and positively disposed to the instrumentalization of spiritual practices and concepts by reducing them to vehicles that offer advice about adaptation to reality. The astrological advice that is brought to us by a newspaper or a website rather than by our local seer or shaman takes part in a modern culture of occultism that contributes to the light authoritarianism of psychological adaptation. We are taught to accept the world as it is at the same time that we are encouraged to believe that improvements can only be made on the home or the self. In The Stars Down to Earth, the belief in astrology under the conditions of modernity is based upon certain psychological elements that are necessary to an acceptance of fascism. 1, voluptuous passivity before absolute authority. 2, semi-erudition, a state of literacy that Adorno says affords its subjects a certain air of pseudo-skepticism with regard to specialists of any kind. In fields, he emphasizes outside of the sciences, actually. And 3, willingness to accept the existence of a conspiracy of distant and mysterious forces that conspire to determine every aspect of our lives. At first glance, such an argument may seem outrageous. How can the reader of the Los Angeles Times astrological column in 1953 be in any way compared to a fascist sympathizer? Its hyperbolic qualities, as well as Adorno's exclusive use of close reading to deal with his material, make the thesis of this book rather difficult for the social scientist to accept. To historical materialists and Freudians alike, it may also appear that Adorno has gone too far, overshot his mark in choosing such a banal, if not ridiculous, object of criticism. Adorno may have launched a missile to destroy an anthill, but that anthill yields a rich network of associations that have everything to do with an understanding of a constellation of problems and questions that lie at the foundation of our modernity. Constellation is, of course, the term that Walter Benjamin activates in order to provide an image for his methodology. Constellation is vital for an understanding of representation in Benjamin's work, especially in terms of history. The flash or shock that illuminates only a partial field of the past and the configuration of images rendered visible is spread out on the darkness of the night sky, as if in a constellation. Of course, Adorno's objections to Benjamin's quasi-mystical and non-dialectical description of our relationship to history may also be read in his critique of astrology. There may, in fact, be something that can be redeemed in the contemplation of the heavens that Jack Lindsay, historian of astrology, hints at when he writes, and I'm going to quote at length here, "The main motive force driving men to watch the stars was a hope of reducing their movements to regular patterns, which could be understood and foreseen. Since this activity went on within cultural systems in which the notion of vital correspondence between heaven and earth was central, it at no time asserted itself as a disinterested and abstract search for knowledge. This in itself is a valid enough attitude. What we now see as fantasy was just the extremely oversimplified way in which the correspondences were seen and treated. The reaction came in the 16th century with the slow foundation of the scientific attitude, which totally excluded men from the world of natural phenomenon." End quote. The exclusion of the human being as the measure of celestial movement and a concomitant rejection of anthropomorphism allowed for real progress to be made in the science of astronomy, but it produced at the same time a disorienting absence, which Jacques Lacan has tried to theorize as the subject of science. This culture of contemporary occultism is characterized by its attempt to fill that void with something else. And part of that filling of the void has to do with a radical openness to all religious practices. In the New Age's criticism of dogma and rigid rituals, it makes an open embrace of all eclectic spiritual practices, from the Native American to the Taoist, and its unquestioning use of these practices all conspire to make life easier to take. Richard Hofstadter draws a stark portrait of the effects of a combination of anti-intellectualism and Protestant revivalism that have shaped American politics as we know it in his Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. Hofstadter demonstrates that the exploitation of the popular and almost superstitious fear of eggheads and experts has been a driving force behind reactionary evangelism, which then he identifies as a form of superstition. Contemporary astrology may seem more benign than the conformist and apocalyptic type that Adorno studied briefly in the beginning of the 1950s, but the predictions of the New Age continue to replicate structures of paranoiac projection. Quote, "Inasmuch as the social system is the fate of most individuals, independent of their will and interest, it is projected upon the stars in order to thus obtain a higher degree of dignity and justification in which the individuals hope to participate themselves." That's Adorno, 1953. The weakness of belief and the prodigious rewards promised make astrology a deal you can't refuse. Its most astonishing predictions have structured the fantasies of the post-protest movement counterculture in the United States, and as a set of secondary superstitions, its embrace of paganism and compatibility with technology offers a stunning configuration of prophecy and capitulation that has inspired in equal parts the cybertopic ex-hippies of Mondo 2000 and the technocrats of Silicon Valley and Alley. Derrida does remind us that the word religion has two possible etymological origins, one from religere, to gather or assemble, and the other one from religare, to bind or tie together. Religion in its Latinized form describes a certain kind of community, implying a certain kind of bond or bind that connects us both to a deity and to each other. This individualized relationship of enjoyment with a distant and powerful force is at the heart of a relationship with the divine that has been fully Christianized even as it seeks out other cultures with which to fill its gaps. A popularized and belated form of Orientalism has paved the way for an appropriation of what is called Eastern spirituality that is supposed to enhance, supplement, or fill out the contemporary relationship with the divine. This then allows for the return of religion to be politically legitimized. That is, its return is staged as an ecumenical accepting, as ecumenical accepting and inclusive of other religious experiences. What historians as different as Michel de Certeau and Alec Howe assert is that the explosion of superstition, crypto-pagan or Christian, for the first in the case of possessions and witches, for the second in the case of astrology, take place at times when there's actually a severe decline in religious belief. Both de Certeau and Howe point to the end of the 17th century as a period of time when Western Europe, after more than a century of religious war, experienced a convulsive return to both witchcraft and astrology. An analogy can be drawn between that period and the period of time that saw a massive revival of interest in astrology and Eastern spirituality, which spread through France, England, and Germany from the late 19th century, I would say, to the present day. What I want to focus on is the way in which this interest in the occult that was precipitated by the massive urbanization of Western Europe and the technological innovations such as telephone, telegraph, and railroad was combined with an interest in the Orient and in Oriental forms of spirituality that has resulted in an instrumentalized and therapeutic form of religion. Edward Said's work, Orientalism, exposed the imperial ambitions of the scholars of the Orient and showed that And he shows that those who overvalued the spirituality of the Orientals were just as apt to condemn them for their immaturity and their lack of discipline. But what I hope to show in the project, and I'm not going to show it today, this is what I hope to show in the future, is that the practice of everyday Orientalism has become a mode of resistance to the rationalism of the West in favor of a fantastic and fantasy intuitive East. And this has prolonged our ahistorical and superstitious attitude towards powerlessness as the formative experience of everyday life in liberal democracy. An apparent tolerance of all religions disguises a process of Christianization and Westernization that proposes the rearrangement of non-Mosaic religions into a reserve, what Heidegger would call the standing reserve, of spiritual images and techniques that enables the subject to feel whole and to reconcile her to her many sides. This kind of pseudo-religiosity not only falls into what Said has isolated as the Orientalist fantasy, it is also a violent attempt to rationalize the irreconcilable differences between religious practices in order to absorb them and bind them into a new international community of believers in the form of applied spirituality. And I do have an anecdote here. After all that I said, I've been critical of anthropology's love of the anecdote. I'm going to give you an anecdote right now. Right after the NASDAQ crash, I guess it was in 2001 now, a dot-com company asked for a feng shui master to come in and look at its feng shui. And I wanted to know, because I knew people who worked there, if they actually sacrificed chickens and smeared chicken blood, because I know that that's part of getting rid of bad feng shui, but no, it didn't happen. It's light feng shui. You know, people don't want the real, shamanistic practices upon which feng shui are based. They want the mirrors placed in the right place, little fountains, the water can, be present, and, the opening up of a window, maybe a skylight. But the, they got like, so maybe what I'm saying is if they really wanted to do it, they should have gone all the way. But I don't know. They get the chickens, kill the chickens, get the chicken blood, do the whole thing. But they didn't. The pseudo-religiosity of the New Age prepared us for cyberspace and connectivity and simultaneity. Mark Taylor has shown that the counterculture of the 60s embraced computer technology and global connectivity as a drug-like medium through which the world was going to be transformed. He identifies the New Age as a millenarist movement that envisions a cataclysmic transformation of the world as we move from the age of Capricorn to the age of Aquarius. He also considers the New Age's relationship to electricity in terms of Hegel's world spirit. The passing from the age of Capricorn to the age of Aquarius, according to those who believe this, will bring about through telecommunications a reconciliation of East and West, North and South, in order to produce a truly user-friendly and new and improved form of religious practices. For Taylor, the promise of cyberspace is an age-old one. He calls it all-at-onceness, that is finally achieved at the terminal, that is, at a computer terminal, where we are continually offered the possibility of experiencing the end of time and the collapse of space. The new age prepared us, then, for such new technologies. The terminality of this religious experience does not, however, remain without possibility of what Bernard Siegert calls the relay. Every user or subject's connectedness to the experience of communication and harmony can resonate like a Veda, mantra, or chant, opening up a spiritual channel of prayer's cosmic vibrations that allows for the one who prays and to believe that what is best for her is also changing the world. Paranoia does not only describe a relationship of defensiveness vis-a-vis external influences, it presupposes a fungibility of inside and outside. The relationship between the individual and her world is paranoid insofar as self-improvement and self-realization are supposed to have a ameliorative effect upon the outside world by steering it towards greater peace and harmony. The teachings of these exotic religions are used to help the westernized subject adapt to the lack of agency or self-determination experienced by subjects of both bureaucracy and late capitalism. Adorno's argument that contemporary astrology's pragmatism betrays modernity's contempt for spiritual life proves applicable to gurus like Deepak Chopra, who offer Eastern wisdom to help people get raises and make more money. Chopra's spiritual advice will be considered, Chopra's spiritual advice should be considered in the context of Norman Vincent Peale and other inspirational Christian writers of mid-century. If Norman Vincent Peale eviscerated Christianity, especially Protestantism, in a way that Max Weber did not predict for an adaptation to the conditions of early 20th century American life, the instrumentalization of world religions continues apace, but the intolerability of differences between Christianity and Judaism, Christianity and Islam, are masked by what we are experiencing as what I'll call a hyperbolic spirituality. Peale's inspirational books, published in the 20s and the 30s, prepared the way for the transformation of the mass-marketed book or bestseller into a medium of self-improvement and self-discipline for the harrowing unpredictability of one's fortunes under global capitalism. Instrumentalization of spirituality is, as we saw for Disseteau, actually a sign of demise of religion. From Norman Vincent, in his Power of Positive Thinking, Americans were able to derive a form of professional solace in connecting with the universal source of everlasting power, which is what he called God. For Hofstadter, who seems to follow Adorno on the score, Peale's teachings actually reflect a gross attenuation of religion, which has practically eliminated all elements of Christian doctrine in statements such as these that were to be found in the inspirational literature of the 1930s. Quote, God is a 24-hour station. All you need to do is plug in, end quote. Or, quote, the body is a receiving set for the catching of the message from the broadcasting station of God, end quote. Peale's own message was even more explicit about mobilizing God as energy source. Quote, there's enough energy in you to blow out the city of New York to rubble. That and nothing else is what advanced physics tells us. This fantasy is in some way realized. On September 11th. Hofstadter goes on to show that the remarkable popularity of a book like Henry Link's best-selling 1936, The Return to Religion, indicates not increasing religious belief, but actually decline of religious experience, especially in its instrumentalization of spirituality as a tool of success and source of energy. So I suppose that actually what I really am doing is criticizing Vattimo's definition of return of religious experience. I try to avoid being explicit, but that will be a part of the larger project. I didn't want to dwell too much on Vattimo today, but the whole notion of the return really, really, the uncritical embrace of this return really rankled with me from the first time I read that essay of his. The image of God as inexhaustible energy source can be traced back to a particular moment of the 19th century popularization of Helmholtz's theories of the conservation of energy. In his lecture, Die Haltung der Kraft, delivered in 1847 in Potsdam, Helmholtz proposed that it is evident that the concepts of matter and force cannot be separately applied to nature. His theory was that the universe contains a stable amount of energy. Energy is not lost. And this notion, this first law of the conservation of energy, was extremely inspiring to 19th century thinkers and seemed to justify scientifically the idea of divine inexhaustibility. The second law became the preoccupation of both materialists and Taylorists. How energy is lost in conversion from one form to another provided new impetus to create more and more efficient forms of production. Anson Rabenbach shows that Helmholtz's ideas had enormous cultural significance, especially in the bourgeois theorization of power as labor power. Since what Adorno and Freud called irrationality has proven almost entirely immune to reason, academics have been eager to abandon the pessimism of critical negativity with regard to both religion and popular culture. For many academics, Adorno and Freud represent a high modernist faith in the power of reason. Their presumed naivete about popular culture gives us license to criticize them for their unenlightened enlightenment values. As far as forms of irrationality go, paranoia seems to enjoy the prestige of authenticity. Many recent academic studies on paranoia seem to celebrate it as a response to the postmodern situation. Daniel Paul Schreiber has taken on the status of a prophet with his gender-bending hallucinations about the end of the world. For Freud, there's no difference between superstitious and paranoid thinking, and in fact, he credits both forms of thought with the same kind of power. Superstitious thinking does possess a kernel of psychological insight, and paranoid thinking mirrors the interpretive processes of analytic system building. Conspiracy theory, then, which is the next big part of this project, I'm moving from astrology to conspiracy theory, as you see very quickly. Conspiracy theory is a form of superstition that possesses a certain perspicuity with regard to the contemporary situation and has emerged as a symptomatic form of dissent with regard to liberal democracy itself. As the space of political activity or engagement is diminished, so irrationality and superstition in contemporary America become more recalcitrant. In Norman Mailer's words, since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, we have been marooned in one of two equally intolerable spiritual states, apathy or paranoia, end quote. The political catastrophes of the age of assassinations, and here we would have to include the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X, have paved the way for the reign of a particularly apathetic form of paranoia. Secondary superstition is a form of paranoia, then, that is endemic to the crisis of contemporary democracy and mass media. In the late Middle Ages, astrology was considered a royal science. Only the king and very wealthy nobles had access to the expertise of a highly trained astrologer. And the beautifully illuminated books that were translated this ancient and mystical science from Greek and Arabic were not available to many more than the circle of the very privileged. In the contemporary United States, the customer is king and should therefore have access to the Council of Kings. The printing press and now the World Wide Web have made astrology and astrological calculations available to all. This democratization of astrology makes it both a popular object that is also an artifact that bears the trace of a pre-modern attitude towards celestial influence. Rational critique of astrology falls into the allegorical space left by medieval religious intolerance. Critique, therefore, becomes the protector of orthodoxy and is popularly experienced and perceived as repressive and authoritarian. This may explain why Nancy Reagan's recourse to astrology would seem more reasonable or human than Adorno's critical analysis of it. American academics have embraced a certain paranoid style once attributed by Hofstadter to right-wing religious fanatics. Both Timothy Melly and Mark Fenster, who both recently published books on paranoia in American culture, criticize Hofstadter's liberalism. Melly argues that liberal and masculine ideals of autonomous subjectivity are under threat in an increasingly complex and interconnected world. Therefore, paranoia is the correct reaction to liberalism. According to Melly, one should embrace the fragmentation and porousness of subjectivity as a good post-structuralist male. Mark Fenster's Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture is a more nuanced and politically astute study of conspiracy theories that does address the inadequacy of Hofstadter's critique of conspiracy theory thinking as dangerous populism. For Fenster, Hofstadter's critique of extreme populism only serves to support a hegemonic notion of liberal consensus. While this may be true, the cultures of conspiracy theory that he analyzes are reactions against the failure of consensus politics rather than adequate forms of political dissent. For conspiracy theorists, political analysis is replaced by massive overinterpretation and system building. The drive to master the totality of an inscrutable and traumatically unimaginable world picture is unleashed upon unexplained disasters, from the Kennedy assassinations to the downing of TWA Flight 800. With regard to the events of September 11, 2001, one should look at the conspiracy theories of Thierry Meyssan, a French libertarian who claims that the attacks on the American targets were planned by rogue elements of the American government itself. This kind of paranoia and the diminishing space of secular political conflict must be understood together. Like conspiracy theory, astrological calculation maintains a quasi-theological relationship with the future that is based upon a kind of mystified erudition. Both astrology and conspiracy theory now flourish as segments of cyberspace. As a remnant of the magical relationship with the natural world, astrology affirms an alternative relationship to it that resists, albeit in a weak way, scientific reason. Like conspiracy theory thinking, astrology projects the question of influence onto distant and powerful forces that work together to determine an individual's fate. But both forms of paranoid thinking allow only for interpretation and prophecy, rather than analysis, speculation, and critique. It is almost impossible to have a rational relationship with stars because they represent the radicalization of distance. They become, as such, objects of fantasy, usually of a paranoid nature, insofar as we imagine ourselves influenced by their mysterious movements. Is it possible to bring the stars down to Earth? One of the most controversial aspects of the process of modernization has to do with the secularization of everyday life. Accompanying secularization, like an evil double, is rationalization, which, with postal addresses and other more advanced forms of surveillance, have produced and undermined autonomy and privacy on the one hand, and community and collectivity on the other. But resistance to both secularization and rationalization take the form of symptoms that demand to be analyzed. Unfathomable distance is always psychic. Between us and the stars lies the unconscious. The contours of distances between stars and us are continually redefined and transformed by science and mathematics. The discoveries of the great astronomers who braved the Inquisition destroyed one view of the astral bodies and replaced it with a version deduced from physics and optics. Rationalizing long distances or disenchanting them as calculable is not only doomed to failure, but bound in its very incompleteness to contain the seeds of a reactionary stance that the Frankfurt School sociologists pessimistically described as highly compatible with authoritarianism and totalitarianism. The New Age offers itself up as a supplementary enlightenment. Reactionary and symptomatic, it is critical for an understanding of forms of pseudo-dissent that offer programs for alternative institutions under liberal democracy. The culture of celebrity is the last section of this larger project that I'm working on. I'm just going to speak about it very briefly right now. The culture of celebrity is related to both astrology and conspiracy theory because it too mediates our relationship to extreme experiences of powerlessness. Max Weber's theories of charisma and institution building allow for us to understand stars in the context of bureaucratic culture. Charisma, neither the leader or the star, is reminiscent of the violence of the feudal lord and leader. These leaders enjoy the remnants of a privilege derived from the extraordinary qualities of a usurper whose authority, quote, knows no agency or control or appeal, no local bailiwicks or exclusive functional jurisdictions, nor does it embrace permanent institutions like our bureaucratic departments, which are independent of persons and of purely personal charisma, end quote. I propose that we consider stardom from Weber's perspective and that we seek to understand how the stars resemble and differ from both bureaucratic and feudal lords and leaders. It is no accident that in the contemporary academic setting, where even forms of transgression can be transformed into professional advancement, the star system should have taken hold as a way of organizing and disseminating knowledge. The charismatic figure or academic star is attractive because she seems free from all institutional constraints, the ones we know all too well from our everyday lives. The transgressive nature of the star performance does nothing to inspire discussion. It produces imitation. The student is reduced to fan, and the fantasy is that by admiring and imitating the charismatic star, something of the transgressive qualities of the latter might be magically and metonymically acquired. And this is another activity commemorative of pre-modern and even pre-Christian forms of worship. If star worship is a reaction against the bureaucratization of all relationships, including pedagogical ones, then it is one that teaches us to accept domination as our fate. Eventually, the conclusions that I will try to draw from my analysis of the cultures of superstition, conspiracy theory, and star worship will be brought to bear upon the diminishing returns of rational discourse in and outside of academia. For if, like the conspiracy theorist, the academic is content with knowing better, it is perhaps due to the highly censored and distorted nature of all public discussion in our media-saturated age. Irrationality should be recognized as a necessary adversary, a worthy enemy with a long history who challenges critical thinking by ensnaring it in chimerical struggles. It can neither be destroyed nor extirpated, but should be engaged strategically and therapeutically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. And I hesitate now to say I'm a fan of you. are presenting, and I think I'll be very brief since I want to open this quickly to the audience. While it is perhaps all too obvious that today we are entering another new age in which it seems that there is a return to a paranoid style in American politics, I'd like to go back a little bit and ask you about the forceful way in which you connect paranoia, astrology, conspiracy, celebrity. And I just give my little anecdote, which is not personal, but it comes from Milan Kundera, who in one of his books explains how, having been blacklisted in Prague by the communist regime, there were two only things he could do, window washing and write horoscopes. And then he would know the birth of dates of certain dignitaries of the party, and then week after week could subtly influence their decisions because he knew that they would somehow read and pay attention to what he was writing. So this shows that somehow there is this universality, maybe of superstition, somehow as a form of weak rationality, weak religiosity. And my first question would have to do with Derrida. Like you, perhaps I have been struck by what looks in Derrida's recent thinking like a sort of return to religion, and at least to the question of religion. And you quote this book in French, but there's also Acts of Religion, in which he seems, but I'm not sure whether I understand his position, to say that there is a deep fraternity between Jewish and Muslim fundamentalism as opposed to what he sees as the domination of what he calls global Latinization, and I quote, the domination of American English, technosciences, and a vague pagano-Christian continuum. In that sense, could we say that paranoia is on the side of fundamentalism or on the side of this world domination? This is a broad question, but that's one first question. The second question would be closer to psychoanalytic critique, and as you know, the way Adorno somehow avoids in his discourse the psychoanalytic idiom, thinking of the way in which it seems to me, at least, maybe thanks to Lacan, who in the 30s wrote his doctoral dissertation on paranoia, as you know, wrote on the case of a woman who stabbed an actress. And Lacan insists upon the fact that Aimé, as she was called by Lacan, stabbed this actress because she was a star, une vedette. And this, this is a recurrent motive here, but the question would be, following Lacan, perhaps, could we say that the impact of Lacanian ideas have put paranoia back on the map as some kind of epistemological problem? Mm-hmm. And the question would be, what can we learn from paranoia?
Very quickly, I think that's a very, very good way of putting it. Paranoia, I think, is offers a kind of epistemology. I want to get back to the Derrida thing, because what you said was very complicated, and I'm going to not do justice to his ideas once again, but I would like you to, those of you who know it better, to perhaps jump in. But what I think he says about Christianity, and he actually calls it ecumenical Christianity, is that it tries to immunize itself against fundamentalism, against its own fundamentalisms, by casting the Muslim as the fundamentalist, or the Jewish person as the fundamentalist. And so this was written in this was published in 1996, and so maybe that has something to do with this, but not. We should take him at his word and just look at the look at what he says here. And he talks about the Christian idea of the holy and the andemne and the and heilig as these particular values. And and so in a certain sense, what he's saying, to grossly simplify, but I'd like to, you know, just use the psychoanalytic structures for a while, is that when you try to secure something pure, you are projecting. To really grossly simplify Derrida, he's saying that we're projecting our Christians project their fundamentalist tendencies. The Christian religion projects its fundamental tendencies on its on the other monotheisms, and that. He doesn't use the term projection, but he uses the word autoimmunize, sandemnise, you know, he uses all of these terms that have to do with immunization and also insurance, actually, because indemnity has so much to do with insurance. And so the ecumenical Christianity wants to protect itself from this kind of you know, problem—the problem of fundamentalism—and that there's no positive moment of what that other of Christianity might be. I mean, he manages to influence Savov to not deal with or not make a statement about what Muslim fundamentalism or Jewish fundamentalism might be, but he does set up this structure, which seems to me to be partaking of this, you know, the analysis on the basis of paranoid projection. Again, maybe this is a kind of, you know, his epistemological grasp of the tensions has to do with a reliance or, you know, kind of deferred dependency on psychoanalytic terms. So that's one thing. I mean, the other thing, what you said about Lacan Aimé, you know, I have to confess, I've been so close to this that I haven't even thought about that, but there's this whole problem of the stalker that I wanted to deal with in this project, and Aimé was a stalker. She stalked this woman, and that's why she was able to get close enough to her to stab her, and she didn't do her any damage, or, you know, irreparable damage, but for Lacan, he thought that this was a, you know, a gesture that was, one shouldn't condemn, but should, you know, really fully understand, and I think that was such a critical moment for his return to Freud in a certain sense. His the question of paranoia within his work is really crucial there. The thing that I would like to emphasize too is that, and I don't think I've made it clear enough in this paper, but there's in the new, why I say the new age in its sort of optimism about the age of Aquarius is also paranoid, is that there is this structure in which you feel that in the paranoid subject actually feels that what is happening inside the body is connected with some global or, you know, wider universal order of change, and that's just that's just the relay. The connection is actually reciprocal in the paranoid fantasy. If you remember in Schreber, the transformations that he undergoes actually have direct effects on God, on Flexig, on, you know, the destruction of the world. You know, there's this, So that connectedness, that paranoid connection that people make with the world has to do with, I think, this, you know, this relationship of determinacy between inside and outside, and in the bourgeois subject between, you know, personal well-being and universal well-being or something like that, and personal care. And so we could even take this from a Foucauldian tack and say the care of the self is actually becomes the care of the world for this new subject of religion. And that's why I can't accept, I have a hard time accepting this Derridean track that people have taken in the exploration of religion. Well, not that they care, I mean, I have a hard time accepting it, but they can go on doing it. But I feel like there hasn't been a fully fledged critique of this. On the other hand, if you look at Andrew Ross's 1986 book on strange weather, which is the only other I think the only other academic engagement with New Age that I found, other than the anthropologists who are working away right now as we speak, he is a tourist. He goes to the biofeedback conferences, and he likes it. You know, he's very anecdotal. You know. He likes the intelligence-enhancing drugs. You know, the whole thing. He likes it.
Thank you very much. I think you've started responding, and
yeah.
Maybe
let me just give the floor over here.
Great.
I actually want to almost implicate some of Jeff's questions, but maybe in a slightly more acute way. The first question is really just a general question about occultism. And leaving fundamentalism aside, it seems to me that the 19th century, especially when you're talking about sort of the roots of this new modernity, is very much linked to a period of not just sort of religious revival, but of major religious revival, especially Catholicism, and the kinds of sightings that you have at Mark Pynchon, at Lourdes, et cetera, where the, you know, angels are showing up to children, et cetera. And it seems that it actually, it's the major religions, and especially Catholicism, that begin to breed occultism in a certain way. Leaving that aside, I'm not simply the second question is just about paranoia in general and about this question of the relationship between a real paranoia, or what we might call psychoanalytically paranoid, and this kind of weak paranoia, which seems like a neurotic version of paranoia that we're talking about today. Because, I mean, surely, you know, we're not going to say that, you know, these people have foreclosed their master signifiers or whatever, you know, we're not going to be technical about it, I don't think, but it seems to me that in some ways, it's a matter of neurotics who are mimicking psychotic fantasies or delusions of a kind of communalism. And I'm wondering if that's your take on it, or if you think that we're really talking about a kind of structural paranoia.
Just as you were talking, I realized that I have to go there and do this work, but I think that, and we're just going to say this today and throw it out there and see what happens, but I think that the psychotic is the star and the neurotic is the fan. So the neurotic aspires to that level of psychosis, never gets there, but, you know, but so the subject of the New Age is someone who wants to be enclosed in the psychotic universe of, you know, the Age of Aquarius, of connectedness and immediacy and influence and telecommunications. Read Mondo 2000, read Are You Serious? There's a whole rhetoric around this that's complete. It's a world picture that's complete. The neurotic is never complete, but he can be aspired to the completion of that. So the foreclosure is something that I think the neurotic, the fan, would aspire to. Yeah, we're going to get back to that discussion. Yeah, you could say that. Yes.
Maybe there's a difference to establish between, say, Andy Warhol, Madonna, and David Koresh.
Oh.
Among the stars.
No. Oh, okay. Maybe, yeah. The David Koresh, I think you'd have to deal with as a guru, as a pedagogical figure. So that's something that we'd have to talk about, you know. And I think we'd have to go back to Zarathustra and talk about the advent of the guru in Nietzsche.
But maybe what is at stake is the what Derrida somehow tries to define as globalization, as Americanization and a weak form of religiosity, somehow, as if the New Age, you know, one of the first uses of the syntag New Age was in England in the 1910s, 20s, with this magazine called The New Age, in which you had dissident socialists, proto-fascists, and intellectuals, artists, and so on. It's of course not the same as the American New Age of California culture, but it's interesting to see that this is indeed something that emerges, I think, out of the 19th century and slowly emerges to some kind of power and visibility in the 30s.
Now, those are really interesting sort of, those are the origins that I think I'm trying to excavate. And I think that the, you know, what you have, you find now, you know, what I was doing was reading around Joyce and Yeats, and Joyce made fun of Yeats's relationship to occultism, but Madame Blavatsky, who was this extraordinarily important figure in all of this, had a circle that Yeats went to, and she supposedly commissioned the translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which turned out to be slightly apocryphal, but still is accepted. Many versions of that are still accepted as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So there's a kind of scholarship slash spiritualization that's happening in, or spiritual tourism that's happening at the end of the 19th century among the Germans and the British, especially, that I think that is really interesting. And she founds the school of Theosophy, and Rudolf Steiner breaks from her and starts the Anthroposophists. And they still exist, and there are Steiner schools that still exist today. And so I think these are legitimate forms of religious returns that one should look at, not just the monotheism. So in a sense, that weakness is what's precisely interesting. If it's a connection, it might be one of alterity. I mean, in fact, what the religious person hates, perhaps the New Age, the subject of the New Age's other is Osama. You know, that this is what a person who wants religion to saturate every aspect of life would most hate. And this is a person who wants to restore sacrifice to the notion of religion in its most radical sense would see this kind of therapeutic ecumenicalism as being, you know, the most deleterious thing possible. So, you know, maybe in a relationship of absolute adversariality, perhaps they're related. Well, if that's it, then thank you very much for coming. Thank you.